Our young people like to sit up front at Southside back home. I mean, junior high age. And one Sunday night, I was making my way to the front, shaking hands before services, and came to their row. And I started shaking hands down the line, and one of them said, "Mr. Bubba, are you preaching tonight?" And I said, "I sure am." And he said, "You are?" And his face lit up, and his eyes got real big, and my head got real big. He turned to the one sitting next to him and said, "He gives short lessons." And that's why he was excited. Well, I don't plan to preach very long tonight, but I do covet your attention in the few minutes we will have together as we consider the things of God. Thank you for your attention, for your singing tonight, for your participation in the things of God. It says something good about you, and I'm glad to be with you tonight. In Jeremiah, the 20th chapter, we are privileged to read a prayer that was uttered by the weeping prophet. Jeremiah comes by his nickname quite honestly. He preached just prior to Israel's captivity by the hands of the Babylonians. But unfortunately, he preached to his own countrymen who grew tired of hearing his doom and destruction. And on one occasion, we read where the princes of Judah grabbed him and lowered him down into a well, where it said that he just sank there at the bottom. Here in Jeremiah chapter 20, he had just been put in the stocks to perhaps cause him to think a bit about what he had been preaching and how tired they were of hearing his proclamation of God's displeasure with his own people. And I want you to notice what the weeping prophet did as all of these things were on his mind and where he turned in his moment of despair as he wept. O Lord, verse 7, Thou hast deceived me, and I was deceived. Thou hast overcome me and prevailed. I have become a laughingstock all day long. Everyone mocks me. For each time I speak, I cry aloud. I proclaim violence and destruction. Because for me the word of the Lord has resulted in reproach and derision all day long. But if I say I will not remember him or speak any more in his name, then in my heart it becomes like a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary of holding it in, and I cannot endure it. For I have heard the whispering of many, terror on every side. Denounce him, yes, let us denounce him. All my trusted friends watching for my fall say, perhaps he will be deceived so that we may prevail against him and take our revenge on him. Now look at verse 14. Cursed be the day when I was born. Let not the day be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father saying, a baby boy has been born to you, and made him very happy. Let that man be like the cities which the Lord overthrew without relenting, and let him hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave and her womb ever pregnant. Why did I come forth from the womb? To look on trouble and sorrow, so that my days have been spent in shame? I don't know about you, but in Houston, Texas, life is probably best illustrated in its purest analysis as a series of these: ups and downs, times of joy, times of sorrow. And doesn't it seem like just when you think you have life figured out, that just when all the pieces of the puzzle are fitting exactly into the place where you thought they ought to go, that is often when disaster strikes, usually from some unexpected source, and the rug is quickly pulled out from underneath your feet, and when things finally stop spinning and turning around, the only thing you can think of is, why me? Why is this happening to me? What did I do? And such a quick turn of events like that can even more quickly turn even the most hopeful optimist into a dreadful pessimist. There are some sermons you preach where you have a specific target audience in mind. Sometimes we're going to preach to the young people. Sometimes you're aiming at non-Christians. Sometimes you're focused on married persons. But this lesson tonight is for everyone. No matter how old you are, no matter how long you've been a Christian, we've all felt feelings of discouragement. And we battle sometimes with this concept that some say, well, a Christian's never supposed to be discouraged. A Christian's supposed to have Philippians 4:4 tattooed on their forehead, which says, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. And so a Christian should never be down like that. Well, the same Apostle Paul said, by inspiration in 2 Corinthians 1, we are despaired even of life. Which one is it? Our problem is not that we experience emotions of discouragement. And when we do, we stand in line behind people like Jeremiah, behind people like Moses, who in Numbers chapter 11 was leading the children of Israel through the wilderness, trying to get to the land sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And all they were doing at turn and turn again was to grumble and complain. This time they complained that they had no meat and they said, let us elect a new leader and go back to Egypt. And Moses hit the sand and there in Numbers chapter 11 he prayed these words, I alone am not able to carry this people. It is too burdensome for me. So if thou art going to deal thus with me, please kill me at once and do not let me see my wretchedness. Elijah, the man of God, after his victory on Mount Carmel, heard the death sentence from Jezebel, who was after him. And he ran for 3 days and came under a juniper tree. And in 1 Kings 19, he prayed these words. He requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough now, O Lord. Take my life, for I am not better than my fathers. So if you have been discouraged, if you've been in despondency and despair, as one guy put it, felt like you were playing handball with the curb, you're in good company. And the problem is not that we experience emotions of discouragement, the problem is how we seek to deal with feelings of discouragement. And so my question to you tonight is not, why are you discouraged? My question is, what are you doing about it? I want to offer tonight a simple 3-step program to dealing with discouragement, but I want to warn you before we get started, this program doesn't work. Oh, it's what we think works. It is sadly often the conduct of godly people trying to lift themselves up from the mud pit like Jeremiah was. But all it succeeds in doing is making lonelier the lonely, adding misery, and it certainly will not help us effectively deal with discouragement. And so with that warning label, I want to proceed to step one. How are we going to lift ourselves up when we feel discouraged and in despair? Well, step number one, pay less attention to prayer. You want to overcome discouragement, what you do first, so often by our activity and our behavior, you pay less attention to prayer. That's one of the first things that goes, isn't it? Our problems are too complicated. Our schedules too filled. Our spirits too oppressed that we just don't have an ounce of energy left to take it to the Lord in prayer. Oh, we'll be up all night on the telephone. We certainly don't have a problem with that. Or we'll spill our souls to anybody who will listen. but we'll turn our backs on Him who can help us the most. Say what you want to say about Jeremiah's pity party here in Jeremiah 20. Say what you want to say about Moses' prayer in Numbers 11 or Elijah in 1 Kings 19, but did you notice the first two words that we read tonight from verse 7? He said, O Lord, and he addressed his concerns to God. Jeremiah might have been discouraged, but he knew who to help him through his feelings of discouragement. He didn't sit there and pout. He didn't retreat to his corner of life and say, woe is me, nobody understands me. He hit his knees and took his concerns to him who could do something about it. And yet what we do is pay less attention to prayer. Even when we've experienced the power of answered prayer in the past, when God has changed the night today, we still do not seek Him in times we need Him the most. I remember a couple of years ago, I was really struggling with impatience. I mean, the kids would do just the smallest thing, and boy, that would set me off. I prayed to God for patience. You know what He did? He put the city of Pasadena under mandatory hurricane evacuation for Hurricane Ike. He put me and my wife and kids in our minivan, stuck in traffic for 15 hours on I-10, trying to evacuate from the storm. Sometimes the answer to the prayer is to immediately remove the difficulty. But sometimes the answer comes in the form of, well, here we are, you're right in the middle of it, are you going to trust me or not? Are you going to abandon all faith? Are you going to leave and turn your back? Are you going to see this all the way through with the strength that God supplies? But the answer comes nonetheless. Who better to help us with our emotions than Him who has created us? Who better to help us than Him who knows every intricate detail about us, about our personalities? And yet we pay less attention to prayer. In Philippians chapter 4, the passage we referred to just a moment ago, Paul said to let your hearts not be anxious for anything, Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. You see the play on words there? He said, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication. Everything. We say, well, this is so insignificant, I wouldn't want to worry the Lord. Well, what are you worried about it for then? And if you've prayed about it, if you've taken it to the Lord, if you've put it into His hands, why are you still concerned? Yet we pay less attention to prayer because we just don't have the energy. Who better to help us to come to our aid than a high priest who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin? Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. He said He is our high priest who is not removed from His people, but who has been here. And because He's been here, that means He's been there and He understands and He knows exactly what you're feeling. The only difference with Him is He never gave in. He never sinned. Think about that. Jesus never one time had to think, boy, I wish I hadn't said that. Not one time did He say, if I could just go back and do today over, I know I'd do it better. And there He stands, waiting to come to our help, or come to our aid in our time of need. Yet we pay less attention to prayer. There was a great fire in the Yellowstone National Park several years back. And after it had been brought under control, the forest rangers were out the next morning and they were surveying the damage. And one of them found a bird that was just charcoal to a crisp. And he took his walking stick and he flipped her over. And there, underneath the bird's outspread wings, were her baby chicks, still alive. It reminded me of what Moses said to the children of Israel in Deuteronomy 32 when he said, the Lord has spread His wings to carry you in His pinions. That's the protection that He has for His children. That's how much He wants us to succeed. And yet in our greatest times of despair and discouragement, we pay less attention to prayer. You want the peace of God that surpasses all comprehension? Take it to the Lord in prayer. It will help in our times of discouragement. Well, you're ready for step number two. You've done that for a little while. You're ready to move on to the next step. And it's like unto the first, because after you pay less attention to prayer for a little while, you, number two, don't worry with worship. Don't worry with worship, because if praying's not helping you, well, assembling with God's people, that's not going to be much benefit either. Think about it. We say to someone, well, we've really been missing you at the services, and we were just calling to see if there was anything that we might do that could help. Well, I've got a lot going on in my life right now, and I need to get all those things straightened out. I need to get all the wrinkles ironed, and once those fall into place, then I'm going to start coming back to church. Now, that's backwards, isn't it? Because what that implies is, well, I don't need the Lord's help. I don't need anybody's help. I'm going to, on my own, get all these things fixed. And once it's all nicely packaged again, then I'm going to turn it back over to God. Don't worry with worship. Start cutting yourself off from the people who want to help. Sometimes we leave the assembly and we say, well, that sure was boring. I didn't get anything out of it. Well, what did you bring to it? Remember, the question is not just what did you get, but what did you give? Worship in our day has become something where we think everyone ought to assemble around our throne. And if we're not singing my favorite songs, well, it's a waste of time. And if the preacher's going too long on some subject that I don't think is important, well, I might as well have just stayed home and done something else. And never more is the consideration of what can I give to God? What can I bring around His throne? We wouldn't dare go to somebody's house empty-handed and not bring something with us, but we'll come week after week to the house of God with nothing to ascribe to Him, nothing to give His holy name. Worship is first giving to God and thanking Him for all He has done for us. It's not everyone else bowing down to our tastes and preferences and needs. It's first giving to Him what He is due. Think about it, song leaders. When was the last time you went and picked your songs? Not because, well, we sing this one pretty, or I like how this sounds, but I think this would best glorify God. And then, when that has been satisfied, the inevitable result is when a collection of God's saints with one intent and purpose come together for that reason, then we glean certain benefits from doing it together. A sharing with those of like precious faith. You know what Hebrews 10 and verse 25 says. Not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day approaching. Do you know what the verse before that says? In Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 24, the writer says, let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Well, what's one way you do that? Not forsaking our assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another and all the more as you see the day approaching. That implies that worship is supposed to be a stimulating activity. The word stimulate that is used there is the same word they would use to prick or prod an ox or some beast of burden. And he said, we stimulate one another to love and good deeds by assembling together. That's one way in which we accomplish that. You know what our problem is sometimes? Worship is not a stimulating activity. It doesn't take people out of discouragement. Sometimes it puts four or five more in. And I certainly want to say this in a guarded way, lest I be misunderstood. But we had best be careful, brethren, that we not allow the charismatic movement to rob us of a spirited public worship service. When we see the purpose, when we see the benefit, Long gone will be our vocabulary, I have to go to church. But we'll see it as our great privilege. And we wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Several of us from Southside had the opportunity to visit a congregation in Timmins, Ontario, Canada, a few years back. Timmins is about 400 miles north of Toronto. It's about 6 blocks south of where Santa Claus lives. It's just way up there. I didn't know the earth went that far north. And here was this little church of 30 first-generation Christians. That is, nobody was taught the gospel by their mother or grandmother or extended family. They learned it all on their own. And now they're trying to be a group of God's people there. We had classes with different groups during the day and then preached a meeting at night. And one 16-year-old boy obeyed the gospel during the meeting. His name was Joey. Joey came from a family that not only did not share his conviction, but admittedly tried to discourage him from being obedient. They wouldn't give him a ride to services. He would walk to the building each time. And after we had been back home 2 or 3 weeks, I called Joey just to see how he was doing. He told me about this Wednesday night. Now, he had timed it just right where he could walk from his house to the building and be there right on time. And he was about to walk out the door, and his dad said, you're not going anywhere till you clean up that kitchen. And he said he looked over there, and the sink was just piled with dishes. And I said, well, I guess you didn't go that night, huh, Joe? He said, I did the dishes, and I ran the whole way and got there just in time. 16-year-old boy on the other end of God's globe, no encouragement from home. Please tell me, what's your excuse? Yet when we get discouraged, when we feel like the whole world is against us, we don't worry with worship. Because it's not all about me. The Bible has not fully revealed to us all that we will do in heaven. But one thing the Bible is clear about is that we will worship in heaven. And if you find no pleasure doing so on this side of eternity, what in the world makes you think you'll enjoy it there? Do you think they're going to have a section roped off somewhere for those who would rather do something else? Some alternative activity while the others are worshiping? Yet when we're discouraged, we choose not to worry with worship. And we think that somehow that will stimulate us to love and good deeds. Well, you're almost ready to graduate. You've made it to step number 3. And that is, after you've paid less attention to prayer and found something else to do when it's time to worship and assemble with the saints. Number 3 is the final drastic step of isolating rather than assimilating. Cut yourself off from those who love you the most. When we're discouraged, do we surround ourselves with people, or do we curl up in a little ball, retreat to our corner, and say, "No one understands what I'm having to go through"? Whenever I just really bomb a sermon, I mean really bad, the last thing I want to do is stand in the back of the auditorium and shake people's hands on their way out and have them lie through their teeth and say, "Good lesson." Because the people know when you bomb one too. We get in the car to go home and Melissa says, "Well, how do you think you did? That's a sure sign something's gone wrong." But I tell you what the best thing to do is when you bomb a sermon. Stand in the back, shake people's hands on the way out. Because there will inevitably be one person who saw through all the misquoted passages and confusing thoughts and flat humor, and they'll look you right in the eye and say, "Man, I needed that. It was like you were preaching right to me. You helped me." I want to tell you, we need one another. We need the benefit of encouragement that comes from being together. We need the experiences of one another. To be surrounded by people that we know understand what we're going through. And yet what we choose is isolate rather than assimilate. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 2, Paul said there that we are to, listen to it, bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. That says, first of all, that life has burdens. But it also says that those burdens at times seem unbearable. And so his solution to that is, well, then you bear them together, one another. That at times when you feel strong, you reach down and help someone up. But that also means that at times when you feel weak, you have the humility to reach up. Instead of saying, "Oh, I can do this. I don't need any help. I've got it on my own." Let someone bear your burden. I don't know who first came up with the idea that somehow solving all of life's problems on your own, by yourself, somehow makes you a stronger person. But it is just not so. All it does is succeed in making lonelier the lonely. The strong person realizes his dependence on God and his need for the family of God. It will help us in our deepest discouragement. Remember Elijah? As he was there under the juniper tree in 1 Kings 19, and there he requested for himself that he might die. He said in verse 10 of that same text, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." Discouragement sometimes causes us to narrow our vision, to where we can't see other people who are fighting the same battles we are. We only see our own problems and our own plight. And so the Lord had to remind the prophet, the man of God, on that very occasion. He said, "I have reserved 7,000, Elijah, who are just like you. 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. You are not alone." I keep in my office at the church building an unnamed file where I put cards that people have sent. Cards from people who made my day and didn't even know it. Cards that I got when I really needed it the most. One of them was from a sister who sent a card after my grandmother died. And she just said, "I remember how it hurts." And what that said to me, and what a simple line it was, is here's somebody who knows what I'm feeling right now, who understands, who has gone through the same thing before. And yet we isolate rather than assimilate. And so doing, we turn our backs on one of God's greatest blessings that He's given to His children. We want somebody who understands, somebody who knows, somebody who feels with us. And so is our family, our fellow army, who together will decide we will not bow the knee to the Baal of discouragement. But we will bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Feelings of discouragement and despair are nothing to be ashamed of. Godly people in the past have experienced them. Godly people may suffer from them even tonight. Remember, the question is not, why are you discouraged? We've all been there. The question is, what are you doing about it? In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, notice the words of the Apostle Paul when he said in verse 8, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed," he said, "but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body." If I may translate that into what I sometimes call the Babylonian version, we are down, but we are not out. We are tempted to give up. But we will in fact give more and give everything so that we may carry out the purpose that God has called us to do in these earthen vessels. A temporary setting where one day we can cast our crown before Him. Jesus spoke on the mountain of transfiguration to two men, Moses and Elijah. Two men on separate occasions who had requested that God just take their life. But because they persevered, because they kept trusting, because they did not lose their faith, they stood in glory and spoke with the Son of God. They were able to inherit the kingdom prepared for the faithful. I don't know if this is the way it looked when Jesus said it, but I have this picture in my mind. It was the end of a long, hot day. The farmers are coming in from the fields and they're tired and sunburned. Fishermen are coming in from the sea and they're dehydrated and parched. And He stands up somewhere so everyone can see Him and holds out His hands and says, "Come to Me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And the rest He was talking about was not rest from physical labor, but rest from our sins, a spiritual rest that only comes by being right with God. And if we will stay faithful to what we have promised when we committed ourselves to Him and His service, then we can have a hope of heaven where there is no longer any mourning or crying or pain. Death itself will have passed away. Would you come and heed the call of Jesus tonight? All who are weary and heavy laden, and you can have rest. You can come confessing your faith and repenting of your sins and be washed with Him in baptism tonight to have all those things forgiven. If you've done that and you've been distracted in some way and you've given in to discouragement and you want the help of your fellow brothers and sisters who wants you to go to heaven, then why don't you make that known some way? Let us help. Do it right now while together we stand and while we sing.